This is a Truth for Today tape recording. Oscar M. Baker is speaking, and this date is June the 4th, 1986. I thought that I would pick a little something that from the Old Testament that might be of encouragement and help to us today. There are a lot of things about Old Testament characters that we can sort of copy today with profit. Some wonderful characters there that believed God and did what God wanted them to do. I'd like for you to turn with me to Nehemiah, the second chapter. Nehemiah, the second chapter. About page 634 in your companion Bible. Nehemiah 2. Now Nehemiah, at the time that this book opens, is a cupbearer to the king of Medo-Persia. And the king of Medo-Persia, his name is Artaxerxes, here in the first verse of this, but we understand that this is only one of his names, and that he has other names by which he goes. And he had a queen, as we find later down in this, and she is not named. Now, this, no doubt, is King Darius, Artaxerxes, another name. The queen is Esther, and later on they have a son by the name of Cyrus. Now this Ahasuerus, or Artaxerxes, had been related to Nebuchadnezzar as a brother-in-law, who was the king of Babylon. And he was the one that ruled for the 7 years in Babylon that King Nebuchadnezzar's out in the fields eating grass. Didn't know much. So he took it over at that time. I'm giving a little bit of history for a background here. I might also give you another little background, too. There's all these fables about the lost tribes of Israel and so on. Well, the plain truth is just this, that Israel, the 10 tribes, were first taken by Assyria. That's the Assyrians, taken to Nineveh, their capital city mainly. And then later on, a number of years later, Judah was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar and taken to Babylon. Well, then in the meantime, Babylon took Assyria, and so then the 10 tribes in Assyria and the 2 tribes in Babylon were all run under the same rule in the same country. That'll give you a little outline of this. And so then when Cyrus, the son of Ahasuerus and Esther, took Babylon, then he had all the tribes of Israel, all 12 tribes, under his control. And he was very kind and gave money to help rebuild the temple and so on, being, we would say, a half-Jew, which of course is a misnomer because they're either a Jew or were not. They were Jewish, they were a son of a Jewish father, but being of a Jewish mother didn't cut any ice, didn't make any difference. Now, if you've got your place here at Nehemiah 2, Nehemiah speaking, and it came to pass in the month Nisan, the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. I had not been before time sad in his presence. Now, about the most dangerous job that you could have in a kingdom at that time would be the cupbearer to the king, just to taste all the wine before the king drank, to be sure it wasn't poisoned, for one thing. And if he made any mismoves or anything like that, death would be practically instantly. So he had to be very careful in his actions and what he said and so on. And so here he's giving the wine into the king, as he's supposed to do. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick. This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid, and said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad, when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Speaking of Jerusalem. Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request? What would you like to have? So I prayed to the God of heaven. This was a critical time. Nehemiah knew it. Here might be a chance. So he prays. And I said unto the king, If it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, that would be Esther, For how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come unto Judah. Remember, when this land was taken, it was all portioned out and given under governors, and so on. It was ruled over. I might just make this suggestion in here, too. Here is that Nehemiah had just heard of the destruction of Jerusalem, and their captivity has lasted for many years. No news had come back to these Jews about it, what was going on. And so that's why he was sad then, when he found out that the city had been destroyed. All right, verse 8. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace, which appertain to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me, according to the good hand of my God upon me, an answer to prayer. Then I came to the governors beyond the river, and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. And the king was kind to him, wasn't he? But when Sanballat the Horonite, and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, he grieved them exceedingly that there was a man, that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Well, probably this, according to the notes here, this Tobiah was a servant, probably a freed servant. Anyhow, they didn't like Israel, and so they weren't going to like what Nehemiah was going to do. So I came to Jerusalem, was there 3 days. Now, what time did the king arise, or did Nehemiah arise? Then I arose in the night. Ambition, isn't it? Well, he was an ambitious man. He got things done. Well, did he have to work alone? Well, he had some cooperation. I and some few men with me. And did he go about telling what he was doing and bragging what he was going to do and so on? No, it says here in this verse 12, Neither told I any man but my God had put my heart to do at Jerusalem. And neither was there any beast with me, save the beast that I rode upon. And where did he get his orders? Well, it says God put it in his heart there in that verse 12. That's where he got his orders. God told him what to do. Well, now, did he begin his work without first planning it? A lot of people do, you know. They start out doing something and plan it as they go. Sometimes it's a monstrosity. No, it says in verse 13, I went up by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung fort, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which are broken down, and the gates are all consumed with fire. So he looks the situation over and plans what he's going to do. where he's going to put these walls and all of that. And he says, and I went onto the gate of the fountain to the king's pool. There was no place for the beast. I was under me to pass. Then I went up at night by the brook and viewed the wall and turned back and entered by the gate in the valley and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I went or what I did. He was planning all of this and getting it done without somebody interfering. Neither had I yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. Now in verse 17, what did he ask the people to do? And I said unto them, we see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem hath waste, and the gate lieth waste, and the gates are overburned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. So he's asking the people to help build up and to fix it so that they would have a name again, not be a reproach. Well, then the question is, upon whom did he depend for strength and help? And so in 2:18, then I told him of the hand of my God, which was given upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, and here is the cooperation. This is the effect. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. Well, what did he think of this job anyhow? Well, he calls it here a good work, doesn't he? So, that is something about it. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. It made me think of something. Now, way back when I was a youngster and a fellow started to do some work, heavy work or something like that, like splitting wood or something like that, he'd spit on his hands so he could get a good hold on the axe handle or whatever he's handling or shovel. I just can't imagine these fellows went to work like that. They really meant business. Now, I know that doesn't sound good today and so on, but that is an old custom. I haven't been around workmen to do it. Did that now for a while, so I don't know whether the custom still exists or not. Maybe people aren't that ambitious yet today. Who knows? Well, then, we have a little interlude here. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Geshem, the Arabian, heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? Then I answered them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. They were Samaritans. They had no business in this. They had seceded from Israel and went their own way, and so they had nothing in it. All right, now going on. Is there any system or order to the work now, since it's a good work and so on? Well, chapter 3, and verses 2, 4, and 5. And next unto him builded the men of Jericho. Well, I'm going to read the first one too. Then Elisha, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priests, and they builded the sheep gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it, even unto the tower of Micah. They sanctified it unto the tower of Hananiel. And next unto him builded the men of Jericho. And next to them builded Zachar, the son of Huri. I want you to notice here. But the fish gate did the sons of Hashaniah build, who also laid the beams thereof, and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, and the bars thereof. And next unto them, you notice this over and over again here, and next unto them, it's all in order, every part body in his place. That's the way to work. And next unto them repaired Merimoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Coz. And next, unto them repaired Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabeel. And next unto them repaired Zadok, the son of Rena. And next unto them the Tekoatites repaired, and their nobles put not their necks to the work of their lord, but the nobles. That doesn't sound good. Well, at least there's a system to it, an order. Well, now, is there going to be a fight? Well, let's see. Moreover, the old gate repaired Jehoiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshulam, the son of Besadiah. They laid the beams thereof, and set the doors thereof, and locks thereof, and the bars thereof. And next to them repaired Melatiah the Gibeonite, and Jadon the Moronathite, the men of Gibeon of Mizpah, under the throne of the governor, on this side the river. And next unto him repaired Uzziah, the son of Harahalah, of the goldsmiths. Next to him also repaired Hananiah, the son of one of the apothecaries. And they fortified Jerusalem unto the broad wall. Now there's a lot of work, but system to it. And if each man took a part of the job and all worked together, why, then they could get the job done. So there was real organization there. Just a little lesson to us maybe for today. When we're doing work for the Lord, there is an excuse for some organization and folks taking their particular parts and so on. Not each one going out and doing his little bit here and there without any regard to the others. We can work together. And these folks did. Now, would he easily give way to his enemies? Could they scare him or anything like that? Well, look at 4:9. And it tells before that how they conspired, all these enemies, and they were going to break down the work, and they were going to report to the king back in Medo-Persia that they were doing wrong and all that sort of thing. They were thinking of everything they could do to stop this work. And that's usually about right. When you start to do some good work, there's always the critics and the enemies and so on who would like to tear it down even before you get it started. And so here, the enemies were conspiring in verse 8 together to come and fight against Jerusalem to hinder it. And verse 9, nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. So he's not going to give up very easy on the fight. Well, how did he encourage his men? We have to have encouragement in things like this, you know. Well, look at 4:14. Well, they're getting their families and everything all together here and working together. It's almost like camping out until they can get something done. You see, they're building a wall first before they build their houses. I'm anticipating. But I, verse 14, and I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and the rest of the people, be ye not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. Well, that's a good incentive to fight, too, because they were there on the scene. If they gave way, there'd be their families going, too. And in this kind of work, do you suppose that he ever stopped for a minute to get advice from all his neighbors? And I looked down in 5:7. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said unto them, the exact usury, every one of his brothers. And I set a great assembly against him. I said unto them, we, after our ability, have redeemed our brethren the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen, and will even sell your brethren, or shall they be sold unto us? They then held their peace and found nothing to answer. Independent. So he consulted with himself on that. He didn't consult with others. Of course, he the whole time was consulting with God, too, and remember that. Well, how about the harmony? Did the people think and work together? Now, we can go over to 5:13 and find the answer to that. Verse 12, then said they, we will restore them, and will require nothing of them, so we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests, and took an oath of them, that they should do according to this promise. And I shook my lap, and said, so God shake out every man from his house, and from his labor, that performeth not this promise. Even thus shall he be shaken out, and emptied. And all the congregation said, Amen, and praised the Lord. And the people did according to this promise. My, if you can get people to work together that well today. And next verse talks about his selflessness. And what does it, what shows that he was not selfish? All right. Verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year even into the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. Now, he could have. He could have eaten what the governor paid for and so on, but he didn't. Well, you don't find very many men in the Lord's work today who would do it for nothing, do you? Rather strange. I might read the next verse, but the former governors that had been before me were chargeable unto the people, and had taken them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people, but so did not I, because of the fear of God. So the people who had been ruling under the king's rule here, they had taxed the people. They had taken from them to live. But here, Nehemiah doesn't do anything like that. Well, selfishness, I guess, is a great evil at that. And there's another thing, too. Perseverance, stick-to-itiveness, all that sort of thing. You can find that in 6:3. A lot of these folks are trying to do some mischief and go against him and so on. So I sent messages unto them saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? There's always somebody who wants you to stop and argue with them and plan and this and that and the other thing when you're doing something. They want to hinder you, to slow you down and bother you. And that's what they're doing with him. They wanted to get this work stopped. And, well, it didn't work. He says, I'm doing a great work. And in 6:11, we can see why that he wasn't afraid. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Now, you see, at that time, if the man was hard pushed and so on, why, he could flee into the temple and they couldn't arrest him there. We have the Lord giving one instance, however, where they slew a man, was hanging to the horns of the altar, but that was a dastardly deed and was not according to the law. And so, he says, what should a man as I do to flee, to save his life? And did he finish what he started to do? his accomplishment, 615. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month, Elul, in 52 days. Now with all that gang working together, all those families and so on, and the priests and everybody working together, just think, they built up that wall in 52 days. Now if you knew how big some of those stones were, and all the work it took together to get them into place and so on, and here less than 2 months they build that wall, you really have accomplished something. Of course, now remember that Jerusalem wasn't such a big city in those days as we might think. It was more of a fort than anything else as far as that goes. And I think sometimes we get some mixed ideas. I'll just give you an instance of one. There's the city of Jericho. Now, according to our reasons today, it wouldn't be a city. We'd say it was more of a fort. I have a field out here on my farm, just north of my barn, that's big enough to contain the city of Jericho. And that field is only 11 acres. They've unearthed Jericho. They've found the foundation. They've found the walls that fell down at the time that Israel went into the land. They've found all of that. And yet that was covered only about 11 acres. It had only one gate. So if the enemy took one gate, they didn't have another one to go out at. They'd have to go over the wall or something. You see, they did their farming and so on outside the city. And some of them traveled out maybe a few miles or to do their farming and so on. But the city was their place of refuge. In fact, in many of these communities, the people can't wait in the city to stay for the night. But it was well fortified. So if any strong enemy came, they had high walls, in fact, double walls, a space between, and they had plenty of ammunition, including a lot of rocks to throw down on their heads and that sort of thing. Now, if Jericho or a large city, like some of we think of, even our little city of Warsaw here, with a population over 12,000, it'd take a little while for an army to march around that, wouldn't it? A great group of people. Well, remember that on the last day of the siege, they marched around that town 7 times. Well, you can see that's possible if it only occupied a space of around 11 acres. These are things that we need to look into and to learn as we work with the Bible. That there are a lot of little sidelights, a lot of little things we can find here and there, a hint that can give us some light. And also, the findings of the archaeologists are not to be despised either. They can be of help to us too, to get the reality of these things. I remember one man writing about his visiting Palestine several years ago. And he visited the different places. Now this was back just pretty near 100 years ago. And he was on horseback and had to have somebody go along with him as a guide and a guard who belonged to that neighborhood. But he visited, for instance, the city of Gaza, where that Samson had one time stayed overnight. In fact, he stayed against his will because they had taken him. And during the night, he just got up and picked up the walls of the city and walked out and dumped them on a hill. Well, this writer, looking at that, saw out from the gates of where Gaza used to be, there was a hill out there, and about the only one in sight. So he went up there on that and sat on that hill and read the account of Samson doing his great feat. Now that's a good way to study if you have the money and the so on to get into the land and see the places and read about them. It'd be kind of nice to go to Jerusalem and get a guidebook and find where some of these old places were and read the account and go around and look at them. Well, I don't have the wherewith to do that. But it's always been interesting to me to see about this, that after all these years, they go back and they rebuild the city. Now, how long had it been? I didn't say anything about that, did I? Well, now, Nebuchadnezzar took Judah in about the year of 496 B.C. And these folks worked and rebuilt the city and built their temple and dedicated that temple in 405 B.C. Well, the complete time of the captivity, of course, was 70 years. Not counting some of these years in which they rebuilt the city and so on, but the actual time was 70 years. So then we would find that about 426 B.C. was about the time that the decree was given and they began to do the building. And got the temple done. Now, I didn't read anything about that here. We didn't get into that. But they rebuilt the temple and dedicated it. Now, I'll have to tell you something else about this. That was in 405 B.C. that the temple was dedicated. And Daniel, in the 9th chapter, tells us that from the building of the temple until the coming of the Messiah, to set up his kingdom, be 70 weeks. 490 years. That's 70 times 7. 490 years. And if you'd figure from 405, 490 years, you would find it'd be 85 A.D. Now we have certainties like that. According to the prophecy, the Lord should have come in A.D. 70. But Israel would not. And so back in a few years before 70, to be exact, about 21 years before that, before 85, 21 years before that, AD 64, Israel made their final refusal of the gospel of the kingdom at Paul's hired house in Rome. And there, and then, A.D. 64, they were divorced. And this thing that was to have happened in A.D. 85 didn't happen and hasn't happened yet. A lot of folks don't understand these things. But you can take these prophecies and you can lay down the lines and the figures and so on, and you can lay it out. Well now, if Israel had not refused, if they had listened, would have accepted their great truths that were given to them, the Lord would have come in AD 85. They'd have been rescued from the great tribulation, which would be in that year, and set up his kingdom, and the millennial kingdom would have been over about the time of Peter the Hermit was preaching the first crusade for him to go and take the Holy Land. Well, that's how it could have been and how it was. Well, there's another angle to this, too. I'm rambling along here a little bit because these are all closer related. That God gave up Israel at the end of Acts, AD 64. And we note there that since the promise was made to Abraham that his seed should be a blessing to the world and that from them would come a redeemer and a king to rule the world, what else could God do when they refused in Acts 28:28? What else could he do but set some other plan not about this earth but about something else? The earth plan, all the prophecy and so on, was that someday there would be a millennial kingdom. that Israel would be ruled over by the 12 tribes, or by the 12 apostles. And all those 12 tribes would rule over the world, the heathen world of that coming time. It didn't happen. That could have happened, been over, as I said, by a little over 1,000 years after Christ. Or after the end of Acts, I might say. There was an earth purpose to start with, back with Adam, and it was the nations that were given responsibility of taking care of this earth. They tried to ruin it. And so, in chapter 11 of Genesis, only 11 chapters, God gave them up. And this is given in detail over in Romans, the first chapter, verses 18 to 32. So the nations are given up. In chapter 12, the very next chapter, the story goes on. But God called Abram and changed his name to Abraham and gave him great promises. And the gist of that was that of his seed would be a nation, would be a blessing to the world and bring the world back to God. A wonderful promise. And it will be fulfilled. It hasn't yet. Israel had failed just as badly as the nations did. They went into idolatry. Israel went into idolatry. Copied them right to the letter. And so, they even made a god of their temple in the Lord's time. They were worshiping their temple. And the traditions of their fathers. They didn't care anything about truth. They didn't care anything about any later revelations. They didn't care anything about a Messiah coming. They were ruling. They wanted to run things to suit themselves. And so they crucified Christ as King of the Jews. That's the way Pilate put it, at least. He knew what was in their minds. He understood what was going on. Well, these are some things we have to remember as we look over what the happenings of the ages, what's going on, what people are doing, that there's a plan and a purpose, and man's fears are provided for. Now, we live in an age now in which the church, which is the body of Christ, is being called out from among all the nations, including the Jews. There's no distinction, whatever, today. But they are not to occupy the earth. The earth's blessings and its future are all in the hands of Israel, according to the promise to Abraham. And so this church, which is the body of Christ, cannot be on the earth. It's in heavenly places, far above all heavens. Now, whenever this program that we have now is closed, and it may not be too many years yet, maybe 100, Israel will come on the scene again and finish their 21 years. And I might give you a little resume of that since I'm on the subject. The sign in Daniel that there will be a man coming forth getting power, and he does it by politics. That is, he does it by flatteries. That's a politician for you, know. That's how he gets his power and his votes, is flatteries. Until he gets enough power and he can get an army so that none would dare to make war against him. It doesn't take him very long to do that. Not more than about 14 years. So about the first 14 years of that 21 years will be occupied in this man getting his power. Well, then, at the end of the 14 years, he'll make a treaty with Israel, take and rebuild her temple. And it'll be rebuilt just about as fast as Nehemiah did it. Maybe less than 52 days with modern methods and so on. And Israel can come again to their city and worship. But remember that this man, we'll call him the Antichrist, is false. And Israel seems to make a pretty good go of it, according to what we can see from the prophecy. And so at the end of 3.5 years, this fellow is dissatisfied with the bargain. and so he will race them out, close the temple against the Jews, and set up in it an image of himself that can speak, do wonderful things. Well, just about the time that he's got that done, and his Israel kicked out, and he's done that. About that time, right in the midst of that last 7 years, the Lord will come from heaven, but he'll come about 3.5 years after another great event. What happens when that image is set up? At that time, Satan is cast out of heaven into the earth. Revelation 12. And he'll be cast into the earth. And he'll have great wrath. He's mad about everything. He didn't want to be kicked out. The heavens above us. And remember, people who want to go to heaven want to go where Satan is. That's another one of your traditions of Christendom. They want to be with Satan. He's in the heavens above. Prince of the power is the air. Governor of the earth. He has princes there governing the earth, like you find in Daniel. Find fleshly Persia and Grecia. And so there will be probably the greatest pogrom against the Jews there ever has been. It'll be about 3.5 years of that. Till it'll culminate in the Battle of Armageddon. A great slaughter. And as that slaughter is going on, and it looks as if Israel were doomed, the Lord appears. Revelation 19, in the clouds of heaven, is prophesied. And there will be a great time of deliverance for Israel. Well, that's giving you a little idea of the earth's purpose. And you can see that Jeremiah's rebuilding of the temple and so on back in those times was a little foreshadowing of what is going to come in the future. History repeats itself. And so when the Lord comes, one of the first things to do is to rebuild Jerusalem and a temple. Because that temple will be destroyed that they built there in a little while before him under the permission of the Antichrist. And according to the scriptures, and you have a picture of it in the back of your companion Bible, the sanctuary, the holy place, will not be in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah anymore, but about 12 miles north of Jerusalem. And there'll be a great square there, about 60 miles square, holy place that will stretch practically from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Jordan River, taking a whole big patch of ground. And remember this. I see I'm getting short on time here. Remember this, that this promised land that Israel will then occupy will be a lot more than little Palestine, as we call it. That's only a drop in the bucket. Now, if you want the outlines of this, look at your map. And start from the Euphrates River and go north and west. And all of that will form the northern boundary of Israel. It goes almost to the Mediterranean Sea, if you look at your map. That'll be the northern boundary. Well, that's a long, long stretch. Then the boundary on the south is the Persian Gulf and in the east. And also the southern boundary will be a point from the Persian Gulf leading across to about where the Aswan Dam is in Egypt. So to take in lower Egypt. And then from there north up to the edge of the Mediterranean, and Mediterranean will be the western border of it. Now there is a vast land that could support millions of people. And it will. And it'll be the center of the earth. The center of influence, or rule, and so on. And you can see things today that are won't even render to that. There's struggle over in that part of the country to get the preeminence even now. Well, I think that's enough. I hope that I have covered a subject that I wanted to get all of this in with Nehemiah to show that it's only a foreshadowing of what is to come. Now, this is the end of this lesson.